Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, comedian Jimmy Pardo shares a story about bombing at an event so badly that he got chased to his car.
So then Dan introduces me, like, here's your, you know, headliner. And as I'm walking down to go on stage, some guy goes, you as funny as he is? And I said, we're about to find out, sir. And I got on stage, and I'm just killing, just destroying.
Great.
I mean, blowing the roof off the place. Like, they're Def Jam laughing, where they're falling out of their seats, and it's like, yeah, here we go. This is great. So I'm killing, and I'm destroying, and I'm like, okay, great. This is going great. And then, and I'm very sincere when I say this. To this day, between 25 and 30 years later, I don't know what happened, but they turned on me.
Today on the show, comedian Jimmy Pardo shares a really funny story about bombing so badly he got chased away from the gig.
Hey, it's Jimmy Pardo, and you are listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show for almost 9 years, Jimmy, and listen, I know who I'm talking to. I know you're the godfather of podcasts.
Thank you.
2006, you began podcasting.
Yes, that's true. Yes.
Which is like, I mean, because I began this in 2010, so I'm on my ninth year. That makes you at your, what is that?
We just started our 14th year.
14th year.
Yeah.
Stunning.
Yeah.
Stunning.
Thank you.
So anyway, you guys, whether you've been listening to Storyworthy all this time or you have a lot of catching up to do, welcome to the show. Now, I hope you guys enjoyed the show last week with actress and comedian Susan Sager. Do you know Susan Sager?
I don't know Susan. What would I recognize her from?
She was Doris, the dominatrix, in the movie Eating Raoul.
Okay. So I'm going to say no.
It's a cult classic.
I know
it
is.
1982.
It came out right at a time.
That is kind of what she was famous for. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I get it. And I remember that movie being Roger Ebert, or Ebert and Siskel talking about it quite a bit.
Yeah.
And it was like, it was a go-to punchline.
Well,
for some reason. But I never saw it because I was, you and I think are very similar in age. I'm probably older, but.
I am 6 months older than you.
Wait, you know that for a fact?
I know that for a fact.
You were born in July of 66?
January of 66.
Or January, I went the wrong way. I'm in July. I didn't go the wrong way at all. I just said mine.
You see what I'm saying?
So you are 6 months older than me.
Right.
Okay. So.
My point is, no, I didn't really know a lot about Eating Raoul until I looked into it.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you something. It's damn funny.
Okay.
It's like a madcap comedy, and it's very cutting edge for its time. It was really one of the first independent comedies. Independent, like, you know, truly avant-garde and using different camera angles than you ever saw before. And it pushed the envelope. Anyway, so Susan Sager was on the show last week. Her story topic was young and stupid in Hollywood. And, you know. Really, everybody has that story, even if they weren't young at the time.
Yes. Well, we're young to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
We're young to Hollywood. So, you know, I mentioned to somebody about I thought that when I got signed by an agent that I no longer had to buy headshots and stuff, that they would do all of that.
Yeah.
And instead they just went, well, here's our logo, and you now you put that on your headshots.
Oh, it's so funny what people think they do for you, and then in reality what's happening.
Yeah.
I remember one time watching Kathy Griffin's The D-List and how it hit me when I saw her on that show and she had like one assistant with her and the show and you know the whole thing they were running and I thought to myself, that is it at the end of the day. There's somebody working their ass off and if they're lucky they have somebody helping out.
Wouldn't that be nice? I'm so hands-on, but I think I would like an assistant.
Me too.
But I don't know what they would do because I don't know if I would relegate anything. I'd be a great boss to them.
Yeah. Here's what happens, and I've had this happen. I've had interns come in. I've had two people work out really well, but I've also had two people that, you know, basically I taught them everything I know, or at least I felt like I did, or I told them everything I thought they needed to know, and then they decided not to stick around anyway because there's not enough money involved. And when I say not enough, I mean none.
There was none. It's an internship.
So it's really hard to, but yet a lot of people do want to learn this business.
Yes. And especially when you and I started, I mean, you're 9 years in, like you mentioned, not a lot of people were doing it. Now a lot of people are doing this, as we know.
Right.
But back then, to learn this from somebody like you or me was helpful.
I have to say, I remember in the first like 5 years of podcasting, Storyworthy was in the top like 50.
Remember those days?
Every week. I'm mm-hmm. not kidding you.
Like, I know.
Storyworthy was always in the top. It was in the top 10, I'd say, 5 times. Like, mm-hmm. it just was there because it wasn't as much competition. And then all of a sudden, these storytelling, you know, conglomerates come along. Look, NYC in New York and all these. And they have a staff of 15 working on one story for 4 months. You know what I mean?
You can't compete with it.
You can't compete. I can't even compete with the sound quality. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, of course I do.
Yeah, so anyway, yes. It's
by the way, I was number one for a while. Like, I was the number one podcast for a good chunk of change. And now I don't even think I'm in the top 100, which is insanity.
Well, the depends on the category you're in. And then a lot of people shift around their category to try to make them
what should
better
I go
than
to?
They are.
The Jimmy Pardo category? So
no,
that
I think
I'm number
you
one all the time?
Spirituality.
Okay, I'll go to that then. I'll go to spirituality.
Listen, we have so much in common. You don't even know. Not only are we the
wait,
same
what
age,
else?
We both have 12-year-olds.
Yes, we do. And I remember running into you at the movie theater not too far away from here when we both were going to a Mommy and Me movie with our little babies.
I went to Mommy and Me movie every single Tuesday for 2 or 3 years.
I did too. I either came to this one or I went to one near my house on Wednesdays, I think it was.
Yeah.
And then the Grove had it on Mondays, I think.
Those as well. And it's just such a nice respite for a parent to be able to get out and the kid can crawl along or whatever and... I love those moments. I love being a mom.
And I love being a dad.
Yeah.
I love it more than anything in the world.
Isn't that something?
Yes.
And Danielle feels the same as a mom.
Yes.
It's really like so powerful. But wouldn't you say one is definitely the right number?
Well, I don't want to put, I don't want to say.
No, go ahead. Throw anybody else under the bus.
No, I know others that have more than one and they say that's the perfect number.
I see.
My self-involved neurotic head would not be able to handle more than one. Our plan, I think, was to have two.
Yeah.
But the truth is, and I'm going to sound like every parent, like he is such a perfect little boy.
Yeah.
Nobody's perfect, but you know what I'm saying.
Right.
That it was like, you know, we did this one right.
Right.
Why take the chance of having a second one who isn't perfect, at least perfect to us? And I know that's unfair to say, but also, admittedly,
well, there's a reason, you know, when you get pregnant once or, you know, however many children you end up having, there's a reason, you know, so you have to figure it's best for the people involved.
Yeah. And I think we're a neat little trio and Oliver, Danielle and I. And also, like, going back to like being self-involved, you know, we're in a business that we kind of have to worry about ourselves a lot and promoting ourselves and doing that. And then I felt like having one kid, I can do that and still have my nonsense. Two or three would be certainly not three. I would never have done that. But two, I think somebody's going to get slighted, and it can't be me.
Yeah,
because I'm the father. Those two. I mean, it has to be me. I mean,
it can't
be the children. So
has Oliver picked up on any of your what you like to do in terms of whether it be acting or writing or just having this producer vibe around you? People coming in, guests, the vibe. Is he picking up on that?
Does he like it? Well, I brought him when I used to work at Conan. I would bring him here, bring him there all the time.
I heard him with you on the Inside Conan show.
Oh yeah, he came with me that day. Uh-huh. So and he used to watch me do the warm up for Conan, and he would sit in the green room and watch the monologue.
Yeah,
and he would laugh harder than anybody, which was just
sweet.
At way too young of an age.
Yeah.
To be getting those jokes. Or maybe he didn't. Maybe he just heard the rhythm or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, I fear he probably wants to be a comedian.
Yeah.
And I hope he does anything else.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, first of all, I want to introduce you guys to comedian Jimmy Pardo is here. I don't think I said that.
No, but hello. They get it.
The point is Jimmy Pardo is here today, so don't go anywhere. Like, at some point, go back and listen to Susan Sager, but not right now. Listen, I'm going to ask you, Jimmy, if he really does want to be a comedian,
yes,
nothing will stop him.
No, I'll support him 100%.
He won't be a comedian. Right.
Yeah.
In other words, that's kind of an easy thing that will shake itself out.
Yes.
Because it's a very... sink or swim. It's not like you're going to sort of half-ass it. I mean, he'll either want to do it or not.
Yeah. You know, I get so many people on the road that come up to me and they're like in their 30s or 40s. And they're like, I always wanted to do this. Like, nah, you didn't really.
Yeah.
Because if you really wanted to, you would have tried.
Not even close. But that being said, like, okay, one time I got the privilege of interviewing Sugar Ray Leonard. Mm-hmm. And I asked him if any of his children were boxers. And he said, he laughed right at me. And he's like, you know, like, first of all, white girl. He didn't say that. I said that. But that was the attitude.
That was internally you took it, yes.
He's looking at me like a... What are you talking about? These kids come from privilege. Why would someone that comes from privilege want to get hit in the face?
Wow.
So now I say to you, why do you think Oliver would want to, you know, have the rejection of a comedian?
I don't know, counselor. I mean, look, my beautiful wife, Danielle Koenig, is a comedy writer, and I'm a stand-up, and I like to say is that, you know, he's the spawn of two clowns.
Yeah.
So I think... It's in
maybe
his
in that in
blood.
That yeah okay and that think, he'll be a very happy comedian and
yes
be different.
And he is a sweet happy boy, and let's hope it stays that way. And you know, I mean, his grandfather was in show business and his grandmother, and so like,
well, listen, I think it's exciting, and my daughter has picked up completely what I do, and what my ex-husband is a filmmaker, and we're a very close modern family, and my daughter has her own YouTube channel, and she's so into producing her
she
own
is
films. She's made 48 films.
Oh my God,
I'm not kidding you. She does stop action creatures with
Oliver. Does that too? Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah. Super cute and super creative, and yeah. I'm super impressed with her editing skills, and
yeah,
it
me
blows
too,
me
man.
Away. Okay. That being said, I host a game show, you host a game show, and my daughter one time took these videos I had of Story Smash, and she cut it.
She did it.
She thought it should be. I told her I needed to be 90 seconds, and I did one for 90 seconds, and we showed people, and you know whose they chose?
I'm just going to guess hers.
Of course.
Based on the...
Of course.
Yeah. I would imagine if I did the same with Oliver that I would lose that battle as
Isn't
well.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, but they know how to do all that stuff more than we do.
They have such an eye. But it's also more than just the technical part. It's the eye. She sees an edit that I wouldn't have seen. Or she just has... I'm just really impressed that she's only 12 and that we'll nurture that. That we want that to happen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's in our vernacular to want that to happen for her. Whereas coming up from Chicago, like you in Pittsburgh, did our families really know to...
No.
Say, oh yeah, you should be a comedian.
My mom did.
She did.
My dad eventually came around to it, but you know, my dad was a Southside Chicago guy who was a great guy and got comedy, but didn't understand. You know, he was for a while. I was like, well, what's Plan B when this doesn't work? What's Plan B? Because why would it work? Right. You know, we're people that get up and go to work and raise a family and get married at 20, like that sort of. Vibe.
That
so,
mentality.
Yeah.
And you're going to have a pension. And this is what we do. There's retirement. And this is the way it goes. Yeah. And so I was the same kind of in terms of the outcast in my family. Everybody else took that path. And it's a great path in terms of safety. And they all have nice things. But anyway, listen, we also have in common.
Yes.
Okay, wait. First of all, your game show.
Yes.
Is called Playing Games.
I have Playing Games with Jimmy Pardo. Yes.
Super fun.
Thank you.
You have people on. Then people call in as well.
Yeah.
And I listened to the one with John Hamm.
Yes.
Was a really good
He's even
one.
Handsome on voice.
I'm telling
in
you.
In voice.
Oh, my gosh.
Is that how it works? Yeah.
You know, he lives here in my neighborhood.
I know exactly where John
I've
lives.
I've seen him from time to time.
Yeah.
And let me tell you something. I'd like to see him take out the trash more often.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
I get it. You, all you ladies. Hell, ladies. I just said on my podcast the other day, if John Hamm and George Clooney were ever in the same scene in a movie, I don't know what I would do.
It's over.
They're just both so charming and handsome.
Yeah, and like, kind, right.
And,
so all those things.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
They tick all the boxes.
Also, you and I both like Ellis Paul. And we've both seen him at McCabe's.
Now, you know...
And Vance Gilbert.
Wow, this is fascinating.
These are deep cuts.
Here's the thing about Ellis. He, on season one, which goes back to 2006, as you mentioned, I've never not funny, I said... nobody moves me, but that's not true. Steve Perry and Jim Croce and Cat Stevens do as well. But at the time, it was like, I said, nobody moves me like Ellis Paul does. Boy, do I want to be friends with Ellis Paul. Mm-hmm. And now Ellis Paul and I are friends.
Wow.
And that's bananas to
me. Well, he's only like 54. He is like
your... Yeah, he's our age, a little bit older than us. Mm-hmm. And he's been on Never Not Funny, I think, 5 times now.
Yeah, I love that you have him on. I think that's really great.
He is great. We had Vance Gilbert on one time as well. Vance, you know, Vance, we saw, maybe a mutual friend of ours, J. Keith Van Stratton.
Yeah.
He dragged us, and I mean that. He's like, hey, I'm going to go see my favorite folk musician, Vance Gilbert. To McCabe's.
Yeah.
And Danielle and I were like, okay, well, we'll go out. It was a nice night out.
That was the first time you saw him? Because I think I saw you there.
Oh, is that true?
I think it was in 2000.
2000, maybe. Yes.
Or 99.
Yes.
I mean, it was a long time ago.
Yes.
And I had one of Vance Gilbert's songs played at my second wedding.
Wait, we had one played at our wedding. Which one did you have played at yours?
Crazy.
What song did you have
played? High Rise.
High Rise is what we had played. You got to be crapping me.
You lie. Really? That's what I had played at my wedding, too.
Love me like Scotch whiskey, and he's a man who...
Yeah, you're still married. That's the good news.
Yes, aww. I am.
Wow.
It was the... As I said, and I've told Vance this since then, it's the one song... obviously, we like some similar music, but we have very different tastes in music, Danielle and I. That was the one song, like it was... Like when we said we need a song for our dance... Like, it was a no-brainer. It was going to be High Rise by Vance Gilbert.
Do you know, Matt sang it to me in our ceremony.
Really?
He sang it in the church.
But again, you're divorced, so...
With a guitar player, yeah.
It was
very beautiful.
Yeah, it's a...
Like, that song still makes me cry.
Me too. Me too.
Wow. And then I loved their combination of Ellis Paul and Vance Gilbert together. I love the stuff they did together.
Yeah, the
9/11
of Rhodes
song
or...
was really good. They're just really wonderful together. Old Tennessee. Oh, well, that's Vance Gilbert.
That's Take It All to Tennessee.
Take It All to Tennessee.
Which is
getting into Dan Fogelberg.
Such a great... you're doing Dan Fogelberg, who I have no less than 90 songs on my phone of Dan Fogelberg.
Yeah, wow, that's crazy. I just tweeted the other day, I'm probably the only one in this gym listening to Dan Fogelberg.
How are you working out to Dan Fogelberg,
that's
though?
That's so funny. Well, listen, I love good music as well. It's like... It's just like I'm listening to music or podcasts. I listen to a lot of podcasts as well, but I listen to a tremendous amount of music. And depending on what I'm working on, I might go to that era. So right now I'm working on this piece about an era in my life when I was a big, huge Dan Fogelberg.
Okay.
And I married a guy because he was like Dan Fogelberg to me.
Really? How many?
No.
How many times have you been married? Just twice. All right. Well, you said it in such a way that time, like, I married a guy.
Let me ask you something. I'll tell you something else. You had one of my ex-boyfriends on your podcast.
Hang on.
Recently.
Give me the initials.
I'm going to let you guess.
Yeah, give me the initials. No, or give me a clue.
How many people have you had on recently? I mean, it's a guy. I'll say that. So take the girls away.
Got it. Hang on. Was it a white guy?
It was
of
a
course,
white guy.
I know. All of my guests are
but
white.
But actually not from America.
Not from America?
But now is American, but not from America. And you did not play the game that day. It was a thorough interview. It was like 2 hours.
Yeah.
It was only three, four guests ago.
Is he Canadian?
He's Russian.
You used to date Yakov Smirnoff?
Isn't that funny?
Yes.
I know.
He was wonderful.
Yeah, he's a really generous guy, really nice guy.
Yeah.
You know, we were really good friends for about a year. And part of that, we kind of dated. But we were friends.
Mm-hmm.
We traveled a lot together.
Oh.
Yeah, right? To places like Dubai.
What?
Mumbai. Yeah,
this is bananas.
It is bananas.
How long ago?
You'll have to have me on your show. I'll tell you all about it.
I don't want to hear anything more.
2015. 2015.
So not that long ago.
Yeah.
All right.
Listen, I'm so excited to hear your story. But before we do, I wanted to remind you guys to follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Storyworthy. I make it that simple and I appreciate it. Also, check out StoryworthyPodcast.com. And then, you know, there's all sorts of stuff going on over there. And you'll learn about my other show, ScrewedUpStories.com with Rachel O'Brien on the Westwood One Network, which we're very happy about. Listen to Screwed Up Stories. And then also, you got to check out Story Smash. Jimmy, tell them how great Story Smash is.
Oh, I love Story Smash. It's one of my favorite things to do.
Really,
I mean that sincerely, not just because I'm sitting
you.
Here. I love it.
We are celebrating our 2-year anniversary in July at the Improv. So
great.
We've done 22 shows there. We have a show in June, and then July is the big two-year anniversary, and I hope you'll come back.
Listen, here's the truth.
You're a really good judge.
Well, I don't know about that. Here's what I'll say. When I see you posting about the shows and I see who the judges are and I was not asked, I literally get jealous.
Yeah.
That's like, oh, I like that show so much. I'm available Saturday. Aww. I wish I was there.
Yeah, I wish I could do it more often.
And yeah.
Then I could have
but
more
it's people. Also work. And you have a life and this, and so
well,
adding...
Well, it's really hard getting stage time. That's really, for me, I mean, even though I've been with the Improv on a steady basis, I sell out every month. It's still, you know, they've got their own agenda,
I know they do.
And there's a lot of people who need stage time. Yeah. So I'm just saying, it's so a lot of it is getting the stage time and getting the audience, as you know.
I mean,
people come, but, you know, more than once a month, I don't know.
I think once a month is the right amount.
Yeah. And so, you know, I love it. And I appreciate you coming on.
I love it.
It's always so fun.
I have fun doing it.
Good.
Yeah. And I'll be back whenever you ask me to be back.
Hooray.
To bees back.
All right, you guys, he's here right now. Jimmy Pardo, as you know, he's a comedian. You've been on so many things. The Tonight Show, Conan, The Late Late Show. You've had your own comedy special on Comedy Central.
I did.
Half hour special. And I have to ask you, you know, I know you've done a lot of things with Conan on the show, like as a panel guest, as a field correspondent, as a sketch player. And you've also done a lot of his warm-up. So I have two things to ask you.
Yes.
One, I know you're doing warm-up and you're watching him do the monologue and you're watching him do what you have also obviously tried to attain, and you've had your own pilots and your own series and the Jimmy Pardo show. So how, because I want those things too. So how does that jive up inside of you in terms of not envy or not jealousy, but wanting to be in that position, but knowing that luck is a lot of it, or... Like, how does that all go?
It all goes, in fact, that's a story in itself. When I got the call to go and be interviewed or to meet with the Conan O'Brien team when they were coming out here from New York to take over to the Tonight Show, and I got the call on a, I think our first, we did a couple of test shows. Like, if one was on a Tuesday, I got the call on the previous
Friday.
I think, or was it the day before? Either way.
Yeah.
They called me up and they said, my manager calls up and says, hey, they want to meet you over at Conan. The Conan people want to meet you to do warm up for the Tonight Show. I was like, nah, pass. I have no interest in that. I'm not a warm up. I moved out here to be a host, to speak to what you were saying. And the truth is, I had a dream, a literal dream, not I have a dream.
Right.
I had an actual dream of working at the Tonight Show. In some, because it's a dream, in some weird, some unknown capacity.
Yeah.
So I had that dream, and then I also thought, you know, get over yourself. This is the Tonight Show, which has been the dream to host that, and my idol Johnny Carson to be part of that quote-unquote family. And I love Conan O'Brien, so why wouldn't I at least take the meeting?
Yeah.
So I took the meeting, and you may have heard this, like Mike Sweeney, the head writer, said I was angry. And I thought I was being strong and about kind of like giving my views and my thoughts on wanting to do it. And I ended up saying yes to the job of warm-up.
Like, who was in the room when you went over to meet? And what did you think they were going to talk to you about?
Okay, well, I knew they were going to offer me
about the
warm-up job.
Okay.
So. And so the first, I met with Mike Sweeney for about maybe 10 minutes.
And he just said, this is what goes down.
We've
got 100 seats or whatever.
Yeah. And I said to him, I go, look, I don't want to be a warm up. I don't want to have to hand out candy. I don't want to do dance contests. I don't want to have a joke off. I don't want to, you know, have to get up in every commercial break and babysit
and
these people. I that's not my bag. But, and he said, good news. We don't do any of that here.
Just want you to talk to the audience.
Yeah,
be normal. Make them feel at home.
That's it. You're going to come out and do 8 minutes. And then introduce Conan, and then you're gone.
Wow.
You can leave. You could do whatever you want to do. And I still was like, I don't know.
Oh, my God. It sounds like a dream.
I know, right? So, but again, the stigma to me of warm-up.
Yeah, in other words, do you want to be an extra in the movie, or do you want to be an actor?
Right. So that said.
How are you going to be seen by other people?
You're not, because you're going to be working there every day, and you're not auditioning, you're not so on and so forth. So, when I was hesitant, he said, well, let's go down and talk to Jeff Ross, the executive producer, not the comedian.
Yeah.
And so I walked into Jeff Ross's office, and it was Jeff Ross, Steve Hollander, the stage manager, Brian Kiley, a writer, and then Mike Sweeney as well. Mm-hmm. So Jeff Ross talks like this. He talks a little bit like this, Jeff Ross. And he's like, he goes, what's going on? Yeah, nice to meet you. You know, it's a warm up. It's a piece of cake. And you start tomorrow. And then Mike goes, he's not sure he wants it. What do you mean you don't want it? What are you talking about? You don't want it. It's a cake gig. You do 8 minutes, you get out of here. And I'm like, I don't know if I really want to be a warm up. I appreciate meeting you guys, but I'm not sure. And then he picks up the phone and he goes, says he's not sure. Says he doesn't want it. And then Conan, who I never met, Let me circle back. Mike Sweeney did tell me in the 10 minutes that I spoke with him, he said, hey, here's the deal. We were talking about, like, who can we get to do the warm-up for the new Tonight Show? And Andy Richter said, and I knew Andy a little bit, not a lot. I knew Andy a little bit from doing some shows at the UCB Theater here in L.A. So Mike Sweeney said that Andy said, well, the guy who can do anywhere from 10 minutes to an hour off the top of his head that has the same sensibilities as our show is Jimmy Pardo. And he said, so then Conan and I looked.
That's a big compliment.
It's the biggest.
And it's very true.
Well.
Because it's kind of the same tone.
It is. And I agree.
It's intelligent.
Yeah.
It's smart. It's not vapid conversation. It's
right.
going to be in the moment and we're going to keep you entertained, but we're also not going to do somersaults.
Exactly. And perfect. So then they, I guess Conan and some people, they looked at my video and I guess they were like a minute into one of the videos that I had on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was me doing like a man on the street thing.
Yeah.
And about a minute in, Conan went, that's our guy,
yeah.
Call him.
And that's all he would need to see, yeah. I'm sure, as well.
So then Conan came, so now to jump back to the other part. So Conan came in, and I never met him. I knew Andy a little bit. I knew the writer, Brian Kiley, because we worked together in Indianapolis 25 years earlier.
Wow.
20 years earlier. So then Conan came in. I'm 5'4.5". He's 6'4.5", so he's a giant to me.
Yeah.
There's no chairs anywhere in the room because everybody's seated. So Conan goes, all right. And then he sits down in what we now call crisscross applesauce.
Oh, that's so good.
So he sits down on the floor. And and it was that moment that I went, if you don't take this job, you're a dick,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So I ended up taking the gig and I did the 4 test shows that we started June 1st of 2009. And then I wasn't good at it. I wasn't good. I was kind of doing an impression of a warm-up of what I'd seen warm-ups do, like going up and down the stairs and talking to people.
I think that would be hard to go up and down the stairs because you could lose your balance, first of all.
Yeah.
And
if people I'm pretty good with stairs, though. I should tell
you
that.
But if you've got the microphone and there was a cord, probably.
No, there's no cord. It's a wireless microphone.
Look, I don't know when this was. When was this? 5 years
2009.
Ago? 2009. Okay.
Yeah,
10 years ago.
There was wireless.
Well, I'm impressed. The point is,
show business.
Going up and down the stairs, people can't see you. And if
that's the problem. They can't
see you. But then how are they going to understand what to do?
But you've been to other tapings where you see the warm up going up and down the stairs, and you see
and
them doing
the
it and going.
That's what looks so hard,
right? And so, like, I tried to do that, and it wasn't working. To what you just spoke on, half the room wouldn't see me, mainly because I'm a tiny guy. They wouldn't see me. They couldn't hear me. They were not invested. So. I don't know why. What happened? One day I woke up and said, why don't you just do it all from the monologue spot? Do it all from the front and just stay on the stage and do it like a stand-up act.
That's what they do at Bill Maher. I go see that taping.
Oh, yeah.
It's a fun taping to go to, and it's easy to get tickets.
Right.
And it's just like a Friday afternoon, 5 o'clock. It's over by 6:30, whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's what the guy does there. The head writer comes out. He just stands exactly where Bill's going to stand. And that's a done deal.
You're the performer. You're not a clown. You're
and
not a minstrel.
Usually so, about 100 people, right? Or how many?
No, we had at the Tonight Show, it was close to 400.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah.
Yes, of course.
So then, of course, to that end.
This was over at NBC.
That was at Universal Studios.
Universal Studios.
They built the Chelsea Handler ended up being in that studio after we left, but they built it for Conan.
Wow.
And it was huge, and I wasn't good at it. And then I was panicked that they were going to fire me at any given moment. You know, this job I didn't want. And then they, I finally settled into it. And then we got fired because Jay Leno wanted his job back.
Yeah.
And somebody thought that was a good idea. So Jay went back on TV. We were off the air for 9 months. Then we went over to TBS. And then I was with Conan there for another 6 years, I want to say.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That's a great job.
It was the great. And I say with no hyperbole, and I say it often, and it's worth repeating every time I do, that in everything I've done in show business, nobody treated me better than Conan O'Brien.
That's so
great. And his staff.
Yeah.
And it changed my career. It changed everything.
I love Conan's podcast now that he does. It's really thorough.
Yeah.
He just did one with Howard Stern.
Get out. That's what I say.
Wow.
I'm the opposite of you. I say, get out of the game. You won. You've got a talk show on television.
Ooh, I know. But I like everybody's content. I listen to a lot of podcasts.
You
don't think he should have
get
a
out.
Show right now.
Get out.
What do you think about Katie Couric? Should she have a podcast?
Yeah, because she's not doing news anymore.
Okay.
Conan won. He's got the talk. He's got what we want.
Okay.
And you won. You got the gold ring. Yeah. Stay out of podcasting. That's like telling get out of my Howard lane, Stern, O'Brien.
Howard Stern, you shouldn't have had a talk show at night, you know, an 11 o'clock slot show at night.
Well, not, I disagree with that because to me, like a lot of people see radio as a step to television.
I see.
Like television and then movies. So if you're on TV winning, you've won.
Okay, what about Anna Faris?
Yeah, get out. Scram.
Mark Maron.
There's a lot of reasons you just scram.
Mark Maron, I actually listen to him every week. I think he's a really good interviewer. However, the amount of angst he still carries, and I know depression is a deep thing, but it's hard to listen to when he has everything I want.
It's,
or it seems to, anyway.
It's hard to listen to a guy complain about things when,
it's what I
again,
want.
He's winning.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That, it's tough. But I also know depression, and at least I'm not that. Or maybe my depression doesn't show itself that way. Check this out, you guys. We're still in the bio, which is super fun because we're not even honestly halfway done with Jimmy's credits. Jimmy, I'm telling you, you've had a fabulous career.
I'm very, you know what, as I say to my dad, I'm not a household name, but I've accomplished a hell of a lot more than I ever thought I would.
You've done some beautiful, fabulous things. You've hosted several game shows.
Yes.
You've had three different comedy albums.
Mm-hmm.
And then you give back. And I love that you give back. You have the Podcast-a-thon fundraiser every year, which is a 12-hour marathon webcast that benefits Smile Train. So is there a reason why you chose Smile Train as your, charity?
The long version of that is that we, at one point, myself, my co-host Matt Belknap, and the guest that day, Pat Francis, who you know well from doing his Rock Solid podcast, he then just coincidentally, the day before he came in to be a guest on the show, I had given to Smile Train.
Yeah.
I donated the $250 that the ad says for $250 you could change a child's life because they go to third world countries and fix cleft palates.
Right.
And my dumb little stupid head understood $250. I can understand it's not throwing money into a pool. Something will happen.
Right.
Cause and effect from my money. So then coincidentally, Pat came in the next day to be the guest on Never Not Funny. And with that same Parade magazine that I saw the day before from the newspaper and said, hey, it might be fun to do like a contest or something to somebody who donates money to wins an auction, gets to be a guest on the show or something. And I was like, hey, that's a great idea. Let's do that. And I said, let's do that mainly because I just gave money to this to this cause. I think it's a great idea,
so
great
said,
cause.
You turn over the magazine, and there it is.
Yeah.
And then you start talking about it on the air.
So we talked about that, and then somebody donated, I forget how much money, and they were to be a guest on Never Not Funny, but they never claimed their prize.
That happens a lot, by the way.
Yeah, people just like to...
If you give away your show like to a silent auction or something, I've done that several times, nobody ever claims it.
Yeah, I think they just enjoy giving. I think they like being part of it. And,
I don't mind.
I don't either. It makes life easier if they don't show up. Are you kidding? So then we were trying to think of a way to, quite frankly, to get attention for Never Not Funny. Like, what can we do? What kind of stunt can we do?
Yeah.
And somebody else had just done I forget who it was. I can never remember the name. They had just done they released a 12-hour, they recorded for 12 hours, but did it, released those episodes one a week.
Mm-hmm.
But they stayed.
They stayed awake and going.
And going for 12 hours.
That's tough.
And so I was like, well, let's do I grew up loving, so Matt Belknap said that. And I said, I grew up loving telethons. I said, also, I don't want to be self-serving where all we're doing is, look at us doing a 12-hour show. Aren't we interesting?
Yeah. It's not
let's
enough.
Do it for a cause. Let's raise money. Let's treat it like a telethon.
Yeah.
So it was like, well, who do we raise that for? And I said, you know what? Let's do it for Smile Train. Let's make them our...
I love it so much.
Yeah.
It's just such a kind thing to do. And do you have a relationship with the people there now?
We do now. Then the first year we did it, actually the first 2 to 3 years, they didn't know why this was happening at all.
Yeah.
And the first year we raised like six... We only went 9 hours from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. And we raised about $6,000.
That's a lot of money.
I think it's insane how much that we raised that much.
Yeah.
And then...
I mean, the first time, like a big thing like that. That's a lot of money.
And again, I always give credit to the fans. They're the ones donating the money.
Sure, sure.
I'm just there running my mouth and being entertaining, hopefully.
It's
beautiful. So we just did our 10th one. And this past year, we raised $275,000.
That is so exciting.
Yeah, it is.
That
and
is
so,
beautiful.
We're at 1 million. I think we're at almost close to 1.3 million is what we've raised for them.
That is
over
so
10 years.
Wonderful.
And Look, I understand if Conan O'Brien did a charity event tomorrow, they would raise more than that.
I am grateful
to the fans. I'm grateful to the famous friends and that come and stop by to be part of it.
It's a community project now.
Yeah.
I think it's exciting, and you made that happen. I love that.
Yay.
And
with Matt and Pat's help.
Yeah, I get it. But still, you're the glue. Mm-hmm. Just say thank you.
Thank you.
And also, you guys, like we were talking about, Jimmy has a fantastic podcast that I also never miss called Never Not Funny. You guys have to check that out on Earwolf. And you can find him on Twitter at Jimmy Pardo and also at his website, jimmypardo.com. And so right now, Jimmy is here to perform his story, performing at a naval base.
Okay, I don't know if I'm going to be performing a story. I'm going to share one with you.
Share the story. But it's called performing at a naval base.
I don't know. Again, this story doesn't have a title. It's not like I'm not Mark Twain going from town to town.
You have to sing it.
All right, fine. So anyhow, this one time... This story is, it is almost 30 years old. That's how old the story is. Maybe 27 years old. I who cares? The point is this. So I got booked to do a naval base in the Chicagoland area. I won't say which one, but if you Google it, you'll figure it out. There's the one. So I got asked to perform there, and I performed there before, and it went pretty well. I had a great show. The money wasn't great. But it was money, and I was still kind of a green comic trying to find myself and, figure out how to be a comedian, find my voice, so on and so forth. And so then the booker called back, and maybe it was 6 months later, might have been a year later, I don't remember how long it was after the first time. She's like, hey, they want to have you back at the naval base. Do you want to do that again? And I was like, absolutely. You kidding me? It's a Tuesday night. I need some money. Why not get paid to do what I'm trying to do here? So... I got to the gig, and again, the first time was wonderful. And the woman, a woman named Cindy, who ran it, was the entertainment director at the Naval Base. Very kind, supportive, appreciative that we would do this.
How many people on the base
that
you're performing for?
Boy, 500?
A big amount of people.
A big amount of people, and it's not in the theater. It was in like the rec hall, so you're on kind of a makeshift stage. It's not raked, so they're kind of on a flat floor. They're all
fluorescent lights and tinging off the roof.
Yeah.
I can hear it. It sounds like a huge space.
It wasn't good for comedy. The fact that it went well the time that I'd been there prior was kind of like, well, how do they make this work? Because this should suck.
Yeah.
And it didn't suck. Okay. So again, so I come back in. So the second time I came, I remember, you got to pull into the base, they got to just check in with a guard at a gate and they let you in. And it's really its own little city. Like there's a McDonald's on the base. Like it's its own thing where like once you're past that gate, you're kind of like in their world,
it's like the Truman Show, but it's for the Navy.
I'll yes. And that, I don't know if it is, but sure. So you're in, so I pull in and I walk into the, where the show is going to be happening, and that Cindy, the talent entertainment director, said, "Oh, Jimmy, so great to see you again." I was working with a guy named Dan Flatley, who was going to be my opening act, and he has since passed away. God rest his soul. But and Dan was a good comic.
Yeah.
Dan was a good comic, and admittedly, maybe was even stronger than me at the time. But for I got this reputation early of being a strong comic, even when I kind of wasn't. And so it was like, okay, well, Dan's going to go up first, and then Jimmy, you'll go up. Dan will do like 20, and then you do 40, 45, like in that area, maybe. And I was like, okay, great, no problem. Last time I went so great, that's not going to be a problem.
Yeah.
So she goes, all right, well, let's go in there and start the show. So we walk through, and they're playing in the song Lee Greenwood's
Proud to be an American.
And all the dudes are on stage line dancing, where they do that thing where they got their thumbs in their belt. Their belt loops, and they're doing like the boot scootin' boogie, and so they're doing that. They're all line dancing, these guys, and they're in their civvies. They're not in their sailor outfits. They're in blue,
but they're still in green. I mean, it's still camo.
No, they're in blue jeans and like mostly flannels and
t-shirts. Some like a bar.
T-shirt. It's a bar. Yes, they're in their. They're regular clothes, like as if they're not like
military.
Yeah, as if you walked into a hillbilly bar. Right, that's kind of how it felt. And like belt buckles the size of a serving tray. And so we start the show, and Dan Flatley goes up, and he's...
Well, how did they get the people off the stage?
Well, they say it's time for the comedy. I mean, so they all know why they're there.
Down.
Yeah,
please.
And they're sailors, so okay. They follow the rules. They do the salute. They go back to their seat, and they get ready to either enjoy or not enjoy comedy. So Dan goes up, Dan Flatley, and he's killing. I mean, they love him. They absolutely love him. And, you know, as a comic that he's like, oh, geez, they're really loving him. This might be, especially back then, like, this might be tough to follow. Like, they might not enjoy me as much as, like, I don't know if I could raise it from how much they're enjoying him. But I did notice that he was working a little bluer than he had, or that I was aware that he had. Mm. And, you know, maybe he was doing that because he walked into a room full of guys in blue jeans, boot scooting. Yeah. And he thought, maybe I got to be dirtier for these guys.
Yeah.
And it worked. It turns out he was probably right. And so... he was being a little dirty, pandering. I remember at the time going, he's pandering, and just getting mad about it. And I don't know if he was pandering as much as he was trying just to survive. And so he did whatever he did, just 20 minutes, 25 minutes, 30 minutes. I forget how much time he had to do. Now, I'm going to circle back, because when I did arrive, this woman, Cindy, said, I'm really glad you're back. We had an incident last week where the headliner bailed after 14 minutes.
Oh, no.
And I was like, oh, who was that? And she told me who it was, and I will not repeat that person's name. And I was like, I go, well, I'm you know, better than that person.
Yeah.
I'm gonna do four. I remember jokingly saying, I'm gonna get my first standing O at 14 minutes. We're gonna be fine. And she's like, oh my God, thank God you're here. And you know, gave me a hug. Like, oh my God, you gotta save it, because last week was such a debacle. And I'm like, yeah, no problem. So then Dan goes up and he's killing and he's destroying.
It's a great night.
And it's a great night. He's like, here we go. Now here comes Daddy, right? So I'm walking down the aisle. So then Dan introduces me. Like, here's your, you know, headliner. I forget what I used to use the credits of like, you know, when you first start, you make up credits. And
yeah.
I said that I was on the Rick D show. And the reason I said that was I once called into the Rick D show, and he liked me. So he talked to me about something for like a minute and a half. And I went, you may have seen him on the Rick D show. And like, no, nobody did. He introduces me. It says, Jimmy Pardo. And as I'm walking down to go on stage, some guy goes, you as funny as he is? And I said, we're about to find out, sir. And I got on stage, and I'm just killing, just destroying.
Great.
I mean, blowing the roof off the place. Like, they're Def Jam laughing where they're falling out of their seats. And, it's like, yeah, here we go. This is great.
Wow. And you're doing your regular thing, what you planned, and
yeah.
It's just working.
Yeah. I do remember that I said one thing that was a little out of character for me at the time. I may say, I remember saying, why do you guys need, and again, I apologize for the language. I said, why do you guys need such big belt buckles? Is that so your girlfriend can see themselves when they're blowing you?
Right.
And the place, you gotta be kidding me. Yeah. They go, they just go crazy.
It's funny.
And they go nuts. And again, that's not really my style of humor, but it's what I like. Why do they have those? That's ridiculous. Yeah. Why do you have a frying pan on your belt? It's insanely big. So I'm killing and I'm destroying, and I'm like, okay, great. This is going great. And I'm very sincere when I say this, to this day, between 25 and 30 years later, I don't know what happened, but they turned on me. I don't know what I said, because I don't think I'd said anything, but they just decided, nah, we're done. We're done.
All of a sudden, they just go silent.
They just, and not just silent, mad that I'm up there. Like, mad that I'm bothering them. Nothing. Look, if anything happened, I'm not aware of it. Because, again, I would go, oh, here's what happened. That guy fainted and then we had to deal with it. But no. So, this is all happening. And they hate me. I, of course, then panic. And I'm like, and I looked down at my watch. And I'm at about 6 minutes. Yeah. So, all I really want to do now is beat last week's headliner. I don't want to be the story. I want to do at least one more minute than the person the week before who only did 14 minutes.
Yeah.
So.
You have to.
That's all I'm thinking about.
That's 10 more minutes away.
10 more minutes of being hated. 8 more minutes, whatever it is. Of just being hated. And I mean, so I'm looking at my watch and like what, you know, what you think is a minute was like 20 seconds. Like, well, that had a bite. No, that didn't bite off any time. And I'm just dry mouthing and getting no response. So then finally I looked down and I was at maybe 13 and a half minutes, maybe 14 minutes.
Are they booing at
they're
any point?
They're not booing as much as they're just kind of, they're starting to talk.
Are they talking? Yeah.
They're ignoring me. I'm bombing. And so I get to 14 minutes and like, I'm there. I got to it. I now in my head, I don't even care if they pay me. I don't want to be the guy that, oh God, Jimmy Pardo was here last week. He did 12 minutes and bailed. He sucks. I didn't want that. Yeah. I still wanted to be the other person that sucks, not me. So I look at my watch, I'm at 14 minutes, and the woman, Cindy, who was elated that I was there, is now looking over the, like she is stunned as to how the look on her face is like, I can't believe that this guy's bombing this badly. And I said, I'm going to tell you, I go, all right, well, I'll close up with this. And she looks like, what do you mean you're closing up with this? Like, and I go, trust me, Cindy, it's for the best. Like from the stage, I said that. Yeah. And she kind of nods. And then I said, well, I'm going to tell you guys one more thing and then go. And some guy yells out, don't even tell us that. Just go. And then another sailor stands up and says, hey, leave him alone. I think he's pretty funny. So I'm like, oh, here we go. But then he looks around. Nobody sides with him. Not one person is on his side. And he looks around and goes, man, not that fucking funny. And sits back down.
God.
So he sits down. And I go into my last bit, which at the time was about getting new glasses and about getting the glaucoma test and all that stuff. And it's got like act outs and it's got it really was like a 4 to 5 minute bit when done correctly.
Yeah.
And it may have lasted a minute tops, 45 seconds. Like so because there's no laughs and I'm talking a mile a minute to just kind of be done with it. And then I remember whatever the punchline was, you know, I delivered the punchline to silence, whatever the big payoff was. And then I go, well, that's it for me. If you see a dick, suck it. And ran off the stage.
That is outrageous. Did they bust out laughing? Did they clap? They had to start clapping. That's hilarious.
It was just, you know, he's done.
Was there something coming up after you that they wanted?
They were going to go back to dancing.
Oh, I see. So, Morley Greenwood.
But they do this every. Well, hang on, they do it every week. They.
So maybe they're not that hard up for entertainment at all. Maybe they are getting too much comedy.
You know what? Maybe you're right. Maybe it's happening too often.
Because you know, maybe they just would rather be line dancing. I don't think you should compete with yourself in this or another comedian. I think you should be competing with line dancing.
Yeah, I'm still going to be mad at them on this.
Yeah.
But hang on. So here's what happens. So I come off the stage. That the aforementioned Cindy is there, and she has my coat in one hand and my check in the other.
Oh, man.
And she said,
oh, my God.
Says to me, get out of here. They will kill you.
Oh, my
God. And I was like, what? And she goes, I'm not kidding. Get out of here.
What?
So I'm like, well, what are you talking about? They, you know, and I then look, and they're all starting to come towards me. And I'm like, she goes, get out of here. And so like she then walks me to the door, and then I run to my car, and they start chasing me.
That is unbelievable.
Yeah. They.
That is unbelievable.
Well, just told them to suck a dick. I mean, come on.
Well, I thought that was more of a funny line. I didn't take it
I also thought that. But I'm not wearing a serving tray for a belt buckle.
So they chased you through the parking lot.
So they chased me, and I'm running to my car. And it's very much like a horror movie where, like, they never get close enough to me. Like, they're always, like, you know, like when the mummy's chasing somebody, it's just out of reach.
Right.
That's kind of how this was.
Oh, my God.
Where they're chasing me. And my heart's pounding because, again, I'm on a naval base where they could kill me and bury me and bury my car.
Yeah, and they all have so many weapons.
Right. Nobody's going to ever know. He came and did his job and then he left.
Yeah.
So I'm running to my car and I get there. And as I always like to say is, again, there's that scene in the horror movie where somebody's trying to open up a car door they can't.
Yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
You go, well, that's bullshit. Nobody's ever that panicked. It's real.
Oh, God.
I'm trying to open up the car.
And they're coming.
And I'm like, oh, you can't. And I'm like moving my hand around. I can't figure out how to put the key into the keyhole. And then finally I got in and then it took off and, you know, saw these guys, you know, just kind of, you know, looking at me and raising their fist with
unbelievable.
Anger.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
That is really a crazy story. Have you performed anywhere with that kind of vibe again?
I did another one in Saginaw, Michigan, where I did not do, where the show had to be 90 minutes.
Yeah.
And I forget the guy that was opening for me, his name. And he's like, the show's going to be 90. And then, so this guy and I, he goes, hey man, I'll do like 40. And then you do 50 or whatever that math is. And yeah, that works out. And then we'll get out of here. And I was like, hey, that sounds great. Let's do that. So he bombs miserably.
And he's off in how fast?
16 minutes. He bails. But the rule at this particular gig was, if you don't do 90 minutes, nobody gets paid.
Oh my God.
So now I got to pick up I got to carry the water for the rest of the show. So, and then, you know, they hated it. Then they hate me. So I'm bombing miserably. The only reason they like me for a little while is that I wasn't him.
Isn't that interesting that if people pay money, they pay a cover charge, they get in, they get a 2-drink minimum. And so it's like $100 a night easily for each person. And they don't want to be on board with the comedian. It doesn't make any sense.
To this day, I don't get it. And comics that say it's never the audience, you're out of your skulls.
Yeah, why are they going to that event if they're not wanting to participate in the fun part of it?
I don't know. I don't understand the mentality. If I'm going to go see a comedy show and heckle and throw tomatoes, you just go and enjoy yourself.
Yeah, or get up and leave. Like I go
or get up and leave.
Now and then I'll see a movie and it's not working. I got to go.
Scram.
I'm just got to go.
Right.
Like the latest Nicole Kidman film. I forget what it was called, but she was like a detective and it was just...
I did not dislike that movie, but I hear what you're saying.
It was tough. But the point is like... Right. I wouldn't just start yelling at the screen.
Well, no, you'd be an insane person if you did that.
Yeah.
So on this particular thing, I finally got to the tail end where it's like, okay, I covered the time. We're going to get paid. And I needed that money. It's not like I could even go, hey, screw you. I'll just get my car and leave. I needed it to buy, you know, to pay rent and buy
everything.
Food. So I said the same thing. I'm going to tell you guys one more thing and just go. And a guy goes, about time. And I said, about time. Sir, I've been up here for an hour and 10 minutes. You know, and he goes, well, I was giving you the benefit of the doubt. And I said, for over an hour? You can figure it out if you hate me instantly.
Yeah.
Now they're loving me.
Yeah.
The crowd is all of a sudden, they're laughing at everything I'm saying.
Oh, good.
So I, you know, just relentlessly just start, I continue just, you know, pummel
wailing
this guy.
Him. Yeah, wailing on
and
him.
And getting bigger and bigger laughs. And he's getting madder and madder. And like the old Bowery Boy movies, he's sitting in the front and he's doing that thing where he's putting one fist into his open hand.
Goodness.
Like, I'm going to kick your ass.
Yeah.
So he's doing that. And same deal. I walk off and the owner, Jack, goes, you might want to leave.
Wow.
And I'm like, okay. And so I run to my car. And then as I'm driving away, I see him run out after me.
Oh my God.
And standing in the middle of the street with his fist raised.
I've met a lot of comedians. Yeah. I've never known anyone to get chased out of the club.
And me twice.
You're
like,
so nice. And you're so affable.
I don't disagree with
you. Do you think this happens at like Dice Clay or when he was at the top of his game?
I don't.
Do you think it happened to Kinison?
Kinison, maybe. Yeah, maybe
Kinison. Do you
think
it happens to like Jeff Ross?
I don't know. I think maybe it did it before Jeff Ross it was a name.
Yeah.
Oh my God,
this is
But
stunning.
Here's the button. You ready for the button? So my girlfriend, Jennifer, the girl I was dating at the time, I then had another gig in near Saginaw about a month later. And I forget, it was a college where, again, did not go very well. But she and I then go to the, after the show, we go to Denny's to have some dinner before we go to, you know, to go back to the hotel or whatever.
Yeah.
And we're sitting there and I look up and I go, Jesus Christ, that's the guy that chased me in my car last month. And she's like, no way. I'm like, I swear to God it is.
You pull your hat down.
And then he looks it over me and you see in his eyes, that's the comedian. And he starts walking over and I grab Jennifer. I go, let's get out of here. And we ran to my car and took off.
That is unbelievable.
Yeah, I know, right?
That is so funny. Wait, why were you? Oh, because it was the same.
Same area.
Yeah. No, that's so funny.
I think it was Flint.
Let me ask you, as such a seasoned comedian, would you rather have a night go as scheduled, as planned? You just deliver your jokes. Everything's pretty good and it goes well and you leave. Or would you rather have something happen like that spontaneously?
No.
Which is what people do like in the live theater situation.
I think, you know, the name of my third album is called Sprezzatura.
Yeah.
Which is Italian for organized chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And I like my show to be, or where it's, I know what's happening.
Yeah.
There's a structure. It may look like I want you to participate and be involved, but I do not.
Right.
Rehearsed to look improvised is another definition of Sprezzatura. And that's my act. And so I want my act to go as smoothly as I want it to go. If something happens, you know, that can derail it and that can be fun, great. But I don't want anybody to be disruptive because they're a horrible, dumb human being.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Is there any comedian that you would pay to see right now? Or do you go, you know, when certain comedians come to town, do you say, oh, I'm going?
Would I pay? Would I go to management and say, could you get me some tickets? I would, my son, and he's not wrong. And as I said, my wife is a comedy writer and a stand-up, but she hasn't done that in a while, and I do this. My son, with two funny people in the house, he's chosen that John Mulaney is his favorite comedian.
No kidding.
Not the people in house. And by the way, he's not wrong. John Mulaney is a handsome young guy, probably in his 30s at this point. If you have not watched his specials, Kid Gorgeous, and then the one that he did from...
I haven't seen him.
My God.
I'm going to make a note right now. Good.
His last two specials are honestly the hardest I've laughed in ages.
Whoa, those are big words.
He's the best. He is truly the best working right now. And then, of course, Brian Regan.
Yeah.
And, then in my alt world, you know, Paul F. Tompkins and Andy Kindler and those
and
folks.
And you're talking about a lot of New York guys, too, and maybe it's also because you don't get to see them as often.
I don't know.
You know, just thinking.
Go along with that.
I have so many favorite comedians that I will always try to go see.
Who?
Like Todd Glass, you know.
I was just about to mention Todd.
I'll always go to see his show because he does a show where he definitely makes the audience come into his world.
Yes.
I mean, he is not at all going by a set list. I mean, I guess he's got a set list in mind. I mean, I think he's got to have beats and he's got to have points.
Yeah, he's got a skeleton, but at the same time, he's willing to let anything... Yeah. Distract him from that.
I did not do stand-up for like the last 12 years because my daughter, you know, was born.
Right.
You know, and going out at night, that's difficult. I'm a single mom. I'm certainly not going to get a babysitter to, you know, go to an open mic. It just, you know.
I get it.
But now she's getting older, so I started going out again about 3 months ago.
And?
I'm up to 6 minutes again. But it's so funny how, like, I could only keep, like, one or two jokes from when I did it 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just not working. That's that material is not my life.
Well, it's
anymore.
Not you. Right.
And so it's actually what I'm doing now is a lot funnier and coming to me a lot faster because I'm seeing it. Also, probably because I've interviewed so many people and talked to so many people. I'm seeing it in a different... I'm seeing it in a different way. I was going to say, and, you know, because I've traveled around the world, you know, and I've watched this guy doing comedy.
Got your story of Dubai.
I sort of have this vision now of what a comedian is. No, but it is interesting in that it's inside baseball to understand what a comedian does to get ready for the show, to do the show, to think about the show, to do the lighting or the prep or to meet with the tech person. And I saw that with Yakov. I mean, I saw the bigger picture of what that looks like.
Yeah.
And it actually gave me a lot of knowledge.
And you do your one-person show as well, right?
Yeah,
did that help with that? I would imagine it did.
I have a one-woman show, and I'm done writing my second one-woman show.
Yay, congratulations.
So I'm going to try to get that up later in the summer. But what I really want to fly is Story Smash. If you had one thing you really want to fly, what do you want that to be? I mean, would it be back to Late Night Talk Show?
That would be
a
game show of some sort.
A game show.
There's nothing I enjoy more than hosting game shows.
What? Me too, though. Why is that? Because it's just so fun to facilitate.
I think it's
because
we grew up on it.
And facilitating like a madcap fun group of fun.
You get to be funny and you get to, when it's your turn, if you pick your times right, you get to be funny, you get to be charming. But there's enough structure that you have to move the beats along. So even if there's a day where everything's not clicking, the structure does the work for you.
There's a payoff.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody wants money.
Do you watch Nailed It?
I do watch Nailed It.
With Nicole Byer. I think that is so funny.
It's perfect.
It's a funny gosh darn show. We never miss it. And the prize is there. The big prize is $10,000. But the middle prize is like a mixer.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, they already got a mixer.
Right.
But nonetheless, I mean, I'm just saying doesn't really matter in that context because, again, it's about everybody's having fun.
Everybody's having fun. And I don't think that show could work on network. I think it's perfect on Netflix. Because I think network executives would not let it breathe the way that it does.
Yeah.
Like when they show fixing microphones, And then Nicole's funny about that. It's like that would never make it on network.
Maybe she'll have you on. Would you want to? You'd want to be on there.
I would be on there in a heartbeat.
Okay, so for instance, Jimmy Pardo, how do you get on Nailed It?
How the hell do I know?
And in other words, like, it's so elusive. And I've been in LA for 21 years, and it's all still elusive. And it's, I know it's always going to be elusive and always going to be a struggle. And it's like when you look at somebody who's doing really well, let's just say Marc Maron, he might be looking at somebody else with the same eyes as that. In other words, it's like everybody, because nobody really knows at the end of the day how it all comes together.
Right. Which is why I spend time with my son, so I don't throw myself off
a
bridge.
I do love spending time with my daughter. It keeps me in the moment. And we do play a lot of games.
Yeah, do you play board games, you mean?
Board games,
Love it.
We play a lot of board games. We play Sorry a lot. Do you like Sorry?
I don't dislike Sorry.
You know, they went down from 4 to 3 pawns, which I don't believe in.
Okay, I don't know what that means. I guess I haven't played Sorry. Wait, Game of Life is what we play.
Oh, yeah. And you get in a little car.
Yeah.
And you can have
we play a lot. He's got Sorry, too, but is that where you press the little thing and the dice flop around? And
that's Trouble.
That's Trouble.
Pop-a-matic, pop the dice, pop a 6, and you go twice.
Okay.
I'm the youngest of 6, so we had board games. That's what we had.
Right.
We didn't have...
We didn't either.
Yeah, so that's kind of the way we grew up. And so I think that's part of both you and I, our attraction, like you said, to game shows, is just the idea of keeping it in the family, keeping it like a healthy, just a nice positive group of people, having a good time.
100%.
We're not drinking. We don't have to be doing a line dance like those bitches at the naval base.
Yeah.
Thank you for
bringing... What if those guys went on to be generals, though? I mean, that would be pretty amazing. Like, anyway, I interrupt you saying thank you. You're welcome.
I just can't believe. No, it's just the craziest. That's the craziest story.
Right?
Especially, these are the men that I think, you know, like I look up to, like, well, these guys are going to be cool, keep it together, mature.
But
they're strong. They're
kids.
Soldiers.
They're 18 years old, right out of high school. They're kids.
That is so true.
Yeah.
And when they're in their combat zone, that's one thing. You know, now we're talking about, what was the famous movie recently about the, you know.
Which one?
The one, the sniper one, and that hot actor played him.
I don't know.
The point is like when it gets into those serious times, talking about, you know, real on, full on, Afghanistan, Iraq, things that are going on, you see these movies portraying it. They don't look like kids there.
No, they don't. Isn't that weird?
That's what I'm saying.
It's like baseball players don't look like kids when they're out on the field. But if they came into the comedy club, you'd go, what are these kids doing here?
I used to be a flight attendant years ago.
Yes.
And I used to fly around hockey teams. And so we would pick them up after their game at like 10:30. Or we wouldn't pick them up. They would come to the airport and we'd fly them to the next gig or whatever. And it would be, you know, the Pittsburgh Penguins or whoever. And those kids were 18, 19, 20. They were children. I was like 26, and I felt like the old lady.
Right.
They were so young, these athletes. I was shocked.
Yeah.
But I guess that's what it is.
That's what it is.
Hey, listen, man, thank you.
It's my honor.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it so much, not only for doing Storyworthy, but for always doing Story Smash when I ask you.
Whenever.
I really appreciate it. Hey, listen, you guys, follow Jimmy over there on Twitter at Jimmy Pardo, and let him know that you like his story, or stories, I should say. And then follow me over there as well at Storyworthy. And I want to thank the sponsors on the show today. Listen, if you didn't hear a sponsor today, fair enough. You did last week. I know you did. So think about that sponsor. Support me, and then you are supporting me and my child. And I appreciate that. I really do. All right, you guys, on behalf of the very talented Jimmy Pardo again, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
My name is Christine Blackburn, saying make it a Storyworthy week. And you can follow me.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.